It's almost impossible to keep up with all the crises in America today. There's inflation, energy costs, drug prices, mental health, supply chains, violent crime, mass shootings, and inequalities of every flavor you can think of. Even COVID is raging again, although nobody seems to really care about that anymore. Meanwhile, we've just kind of accepted all the political animosity everywhere. Then there are all the existential catastrophes on the horizon. We've got climate change, food shortages, and soil depletion, and geopolitical threats in every corner of the globe. Oh, and we have a population crisis in our country, too. We've basically shut down our immigration pipeline, gotten older, and people stopped having babies. Because honestly, who wants to bring an innocent child into the world with a gazillion calamities all happening at once? So what the fuck are we supposed to do about it? Sure, inflation, gas prices, and supply chains will work themselves out. The train of demography will steamroll racial and gender inequality, eventually. And hell, my 15-year-old daughter knows what it takes to reduce mass shootings. That's easy, so long as you're not running for office. But the big problems? Those take science, and a boatload of money, and an almost reckless amount of courage. Thankfully, we also have that in America. Today I'm going to introduce you to my dear friend Astro Teller, the head of an organization simply called X, the so-called moonshot factory of Alphabet, the parent company of Google, YouTube, and a number of other things that have already changed the world. Astro and I talked about how X is trying to solve seemingly unsolvable problems by failing as quickly and shamelessly as possible. We opined on everything from agriculture to the future of work to the best place to sit on an airplane. So join me to meet truly the most brilliant person I've ever known, and me, the dumbest guy in the room. Astro Teller, my dear friend, it is great to see you.
Thanks for having me here, John.
You know, we've done quite a few of these, and I don't know if I've been more excited about any of them than this one. No offense to any of my past guests. But look, I'll ask you the first question, a question I think I answered 1,000-plus times in high school algebra. What is X?
I bet you we get to 5 or 6 different answers of that over the next hour. But let me start with maybe the most functional answer, which is X is a part of Alphabet. And X's job for Alphabet is to make a few things per decade for Alphabet that have some chance of being as good for the world and maybe as valuable to Alphabet in the long run as Google is. So over the last 12 years, we've done a lot of things that we're proud of at X, but probably Google Brain, Waymo, the self-driving cars, Wing, that's the drones for package delivery, and Verily, which is the life science business for Alphabet, are 4 good examples that came from X and are now sort of thriving in the Alphabet ecosystem. So that's sort of our job as a moonshot factory is to produce. We try thousands of things per decade. Almost all of them don't work out to varying degrees. And very occasionally we get something like a Google Brain or a Wing or a Verily or a Waymo that is enough valuable, exciting, good for the world that it justifies all of that exploration.
Well, trying to achieve something that's been as valuable for Alphabet as Google is an incredibly high bar to set. How do you evaluate a project before you'd even call it up? How do you evaluate an idea such that you could even imagine that it would have the kind of scale and impact that Google has had?
So our mission is to make these moonshots, to explore technology opportunities for making the world a radically better place. And so if you worked at X, what I would say is, tell me a story, John, a hypothesis. It has to have the following 3 basic pieces to it before it even counts as a hypothesis. 1, what's the huge problem you're trying to solve? If you can't describe some huge problem you're trying to solve, it's kind of academic. That's not interesting to us. That's not likely to turn into something that's either really great for the world or really valuable for Alphabet. Once you can describe a huge problem with the world, 2, what's your radical proposed solution? There has to be something that sounds like science fiction, that sounds sort of crazy and probably isn't right, because if what you describe as a way to solve that huge problem with the world is sort of what everyone is trying to do, at best, we're in a smartness contest, a working hard contest with the rest of the world. a spending money contest, God forbid, with the rest of the world. And we don't want to do that. So you have to describe some green field where people aren't going and looking. And then number three, you have to describe some kind of breakthrough technology opportunity that makes it just barely possible that that science fiction sounding product or service that you described might actually be buildable and put something we could put out in the world that would solve that huge problem. Once you've described those three things, now we have a moonshot story hypothesis. And the answer is awesome, gorgeous idea, high five for your idea. It's almost certainly wrong. Here's a small amount of money. Go verify that you're wrong so we can throw it away and try the next one. And then very occasionally, you won't be able to verify that it's wrong. And we're going to have to give you more money to try harder to prove that it's wrong. That's how 1,000 plus things per decade get winnowed down to 5, 6, 7 things per decade that look really exceptional.
We're going to come back to the cultural, internal organizational cultural ingredients to thinking and building those things. But you said you're talking about maybe, you mentioned sort of maybe problems in white space that people aren't necessarily honed in on. But a lot of X's projects right now are, or not a lot, but at least a couple that I know of that are at least publicly known, are centered on an issue that lots and lots of people are focused on, which is climate and sustainability. I kind of conflate those two a little bit. So if we think about sustainability and agriculture and so on, but climate and environment, this is a, of course, a, you know, existential problem in our world. Talk about your unique approach to tackling the climate problem. How are you thinking about it maybe differently than others are, in obviously in ways that you're willing to share publicly in a podcast like this?
Sure. So to be clear, we aren't trying to be particularly weird. I guess we're open to it, but we're not trying to be particularly weird or off-piste when it comes to the problems. The problems we talk about at X are the problems everyone else is talking about in the world. Education, poverty, literacy, equality, sustainability. Like, I don't think you would be surprised if you were walking the halls of X, the kinds of problems that get us worked up and we would be really excited about, proud to solve. We're trying to be really weird, off-piste about the proposed solution to those things. And so if we're doing our job right, we're trying to create a place where people can have ideas that are sufficiently unlikely to be right that they wouldn't get funded on the outside. And to be clear, they're mostly not right. So that only makes sense for Alphabets to fund those kinds of explorations if we're really good at stopping most of them before they go too far, which means we need to be entrepreneurial in some of the ways that we show up, but we also need to be almost anti-entrepreneurial in that sort of like do or die, burn the boats at the shore to make sure that your soldiers fight to take Troy as hard as you can get them to fight. Because we're like going up to a lot of cities and like, I wonder if we should take that city. And the answer for most cities is no. So we should not burn our boats. That attitude of sort of zeal to the point of blinding, which is basically what entrepreneurship is, unfortunately, and there are some very good parts of entrepreneurship, but entrepreneurship also tends to blind people with lots of things that would teach them you're going down a path that just isn't a very valuable or useful path for yourself or for the world. Because once you've committed, you got someone to give you $10 million because you said that this was an awesome idea, and then you feel pretty obligated to like continue to say it's a great idea. X is sort of the opposite, where we're starting with, this is probably not right. And that's what allows us to be very efficient at discovering that it's not right. And then when you, if you worked at X, say, it turns out that crazy idea was in fact crazy. It didn't work out. And I say, high five, good for your intellectual honesty. Let's go try the next one. You didn't lose any money. Your kid's college fund isn't damaged by this process. And so we can just go on very quickly. You don't have to change desks or the name of the card on your business card or whatever.
It's a remarkably liberated approach. Can we talk about climate for a minute?
Yeah, for sure.
The things that aren't super top secret, and I know there's tremendous amount of that always happening as well, but what are you working on that's kind of already in a little bit, at least in the public domain, in terms of its visibility that you're excited about?
So let me tell you about some of the journeys we've been on in the past. They're historical, but they will give you maybe a sense of how we explore things. So we explored pretty heavily airborne wind turbines as an example. So this is something almost as large as a 737. It's a huge wing that just goes in a circle in a sky, and it's tethered to the ground. And the what if there was, what if you could have the tip of a huge wind turbine going around in a circle without the other 99% of the concrete and steel necessary to keep that tip in place, because the tip is where all of the power, or almost all of the power, is created. And the answer turned out to be, you can. And we got it working. We were generating almost a megawatt of power and putting it down that cable, about 600-700 kilowatts. It was super exciting. It was out in the water on a buoy. So we're really proud of that. But during the 8 years we explored that, the price of wind and solar came down so fast that the space that we could still be really special in was getting smaller and smaller, to the point we said, okay, that was a good experiment, but we should stop it. We built a tabletop, kind of room scale machine. This was about 7 years ago, for turning seawater into methanol. If you could take green energy and seawater and turn it into methanol, which you could stick in a gas tank and or an internal combustion engine and burn it, and yes, CO2 would go up into the atmosphere, but if you had pulled the CO2 out of the ocean water in the first place, then the whole process, if it's green energy, is carbon neutral. That's save the world kind of stuff. We were so excited about that, tears streaming down people's faces as the first couple of drops of methanol was going into these little vials. But we couldn't convince ourselves that that was going to be cheaper than about $15 a gallon of gas equivalent. So we killed the project. And that doesn't mean that we can't come back to these things. We are exploring green fuels again, but sometimes we have to come back over and over again. We got excited about grid scale energy storage. So Makani is the name of the airborne wind turbine, just to make sure people can connect these to the outside world. Foghorn is the name of turning seawater into methanol. In the case of grid scale storage, one of the many, like, hey, wouldn't it be crazy if, was, if you look at a refrigerator, it has this weird property that if you put 100 watts in, you get maybe 80 watts of cold or 70 watts of cold inside, but you get almost 200 watts of hot out the back. So it seems kind of like you're breaking a law of physics. But someone at X said, well, hold on, what if we just pumped cold this way and hot this way? And we found a really cheap place to store the cold and store the hot. And then later, when we wanted to get the energy back, we take that compressor that was making the cold and making the hot, run it in reverse as a turbine, and get energy back. How efficient could we make that? How cheap could we make that on a per kilowatt basis or per megawatt basis and on a per megawatt hour basis? And it turned out that actually, this is called Malta, that looked really good. We spun that out into an independent business, and they're now building their first gigawatt hour grid scale battery storage facility in Canada this year. And weirdly, they're storing the hot in salt and the cold in hexane, and those are really cheap materials. So the turbine is expensive, but you can get more capacity by just getting more salt. It's very insulated. So those are examples historically of the kinds of things we've explored. Some of the ones more recently, computational agriculture. We're really excited about the sustainability aspects, the business aspects. Food is obviously a central issue for humanity. But we have to get to a place where we can make more calories for humanity in a way that doesn't deplete, that actually regenerates the soil of the earth, because we're quickly killing off the soil of planet Earth by pulling out the nutrients instead of replacing them. And we have to do this in a way that's cheaper and that is way lower carbon footprint, because a quarter of the total CO2 output for humanity comes from making our food. So finding ways to bring automation, robotics, machine learning to the farmers of the world so that they can do what they do better, cheaper, and much lower carbon footprint, super exciting for us as an example of something that's going really well.
That's awesome. Another area I know you're doing some work is Chorus. A lot of our, and I want you to talk a bit of what you can share about Chorus. I know it's one of your earlier projects, happens to be led by our old friend Suresh, which was a great name to see in print after probably 20 years. But a lot of our audience are people in retail, advanced manufacturing kinds of businesses. And of course, you know, one of the biggest challenges they're all confronting now and have been confronting in spades for the last 2.5 years is supply chain. Talk a little bit about how you're thinking. What's your approach to that problem? What maybe can you share about how Chorus aims to tackle that problem?
Sure. So let's start with the huge problem with the world. There's at least $1 trillion a year of waste in the global sort of logistics supply chain. All kinds of waste. Stuff is stolen. Stuff spoils on the way from, you know, where it starts to where it should end. Stuff sits around for so long, gets lost, that people have to put more into the chain than they really need because they're worried that it won't all get to the other side. And then even if it does, then they have extra that they just end up throwing away. That's where that $1 trillion of loss comes from, roughly. It's pretty clear that if you could know where every physical thing in the world was in real time, and you not only could know where it was, but what its state was, right? So for vaccines, you could sort of magically know if it had stayed cold the whole time, if it needs to be kept at a particular temperature, or milk, or whatever that is. For other things, it might be something other than temperature. Has the box been opened, or whatever it is that you might want to know about something? If you could magically know all that, could you use that to build up kind of information and knowledge that probably many of the companies that are listening to this podcast could use to improve their supply chains? Yeah, that's not a stretch to imagine that. Now, people have been imagining kind of roughly that fantasy I just described for at least 2 decades. But usually the story goes, okay, we have this sort of hardware infrastructure, and if you put it everywhere in the world, then we're going to be able to track everything. And once we can track everything, then all the good stuff will happen. But the cost to put all that infrastructure there, which you have to do before you can start adding value, is a bit of a catch-22 that nobody gets invested in. It's sort of like if you said, oh, it's easy to make self-driving cars, but 100% of the cars have to be self-driving. You're never going to get there, right? You have to make the first car that goes on the road drive by itself before you could get to the place where all of them are driving themselves. So what Chorus has been exploring is lightweight ways of enabling this kind of understanding about where everything is. We're early in the process. I'm not suggesting that we're done, but things are going well enough that some very large third-party logistics companies are now working with us. And that means that we then can help lots and lots of other companies because they obviously have a lot of reach. So we're still in what I would call a learning phase about how do we track things at all? How do we get really interesting new kinds of information about what's going on with these things? How often do you need to know where something is? Is it once an hour? Is it once a minute? Questions like, okay, let's say you have that data. What exactly is the knowledge you would want? Let me give you a really simple example. It turns out that the gold standard for ETA, if you send a pallet somewhere, like, you know, across a state or something, they'll just take Google Maps and add like 6 hours. They don't know. I mean, they add 6 hours because on average, it's like 6 hours. That's the hump of the bell curve, but they have no idea why it takes 6 hours or where someone is stopping in the process. Is it because the trucks can't drive some of the places that cars can drive? Are they sitting on a scale somewhere on the highway because they got to get weighed? Like they just, nobody knows. If you could tell them much more accurately when that pallet is going to arrive, then that's a tiny piece, or maybe not so tiny piece, of the waste in the supply chain that you could tune up. So we're early in that process. And obviously, I think this could be exciting just from what we're seeing right now when the supply chain of the world breaks down. There are a lot of problems for humanity that could be solved that have nothing to do with sustainability. But of course, the carbon footprint of that $1 trillion of waste is enormous, and you could tell the entire story of Chorus and what it's trying to do through the lens of sustainability because of the carbon footprint of the waste that we're going after.
Yeah, supply chain is one of those issues that kind of feels sort of mundane and boring and inside baseball and industry, but the COVID era has certainly brought it much more to the forefront with the consumer when the toilet paper wasn't on the shelves and the thing they wanted to buy wasn't available, whatever it is. And it's obviously still happening now. And we've created, for better or for worse, this very deepened sort of sense of impatience with the consumer. They expect things. You know, we can blame the likes of Amazon for that, right? If the thing isn't available for me in a day or two, then I get impatient, which is putting ever more pressure on those supply chains to be able to meet that demand. And then for the brands, the retailers, kind of the thing that also really manifested through COVID is supply chain challenges really solidified this notion that kind of brand loyalty is something of an urban legend, because my loyalty to a brand kind of only goes so far as its availability on the shelf. And that's a big, big challenge for like blue chip brands, particularly like in the grocery store, right? The CPG companies that, you know, I've bought the same razor or the same toilet paper my entire life for no reason other than it just became a habit. But as soon as that thing was unavailable, I jumped to another alternative and I may never come back. And so that it's shaken the industry, the entire market, from the consumer to the logistics to the brand, and in ways that we probably never really fully understood before the last 2.5 years. So,
yeah. And I would add, people's use of Amazon is partly because you're saying Amazon has trained people, but also people's use of Amazon has grown the way it has because Amazon has been so good at getting stuff to people quickly when they want it. So resiliency in the supply chain, as well as just speed of getting the right things to the right place at the right time, I think it's an important part of the future. And in a very different way, the drones for package delivery work that we've done historically, which is now an other bet at Alphabet called Wing, is in the same thing. It just doesn't make sense long term that we would have cars as the last mile solution for 98% of the stuff that gets brought to your house. It's just weird that you would have a 1 pound thing brought to you by a 10,000, 30,000 pound truck.
Yeah. And back to your point earlier about sort of these big problems you're trying to solve, this is another example of it. You know, Amazon, with all of its resources and all of its logistics expertise and all of its manpower, what have you, workforce, the fact that they have their own supply, if they have supply chain and logistics problems and all the money they have to throw at it, it is a massive, massive problem. So it's exactly the kind of thing I'm glad to know you guys are trying to tackle. I'd like to elevate the conversation a little bit, and I teased this a bit earlier. So you've got this dedication, this devotion, this obsession about innovation, the risks and rewards, and we're going to talk about failure too, because I know that's a big part of like your stump speech that I've seen a few times. How do you create a culture within your team? You're obviously hiring the smartest, brightest people in the world into your organization, people who quite frankly have lots of alternatives in the current job market, right? They're probably highly desirable in lots of other places. They're the types of people who can make decisions that aren't simply based on the size of the paycheck. How do you build this culture, this innovative culture, build it and maintain it, right? So how do you think about what types of people tend to thrive and are attracted to your culture? And then how do you build on that once they're there? What's your approach to that?
Well, let's do this by both, I'm going to sort of try to recruit you so that you can think about it and the listeners can think about this from the perspective of someone, should you come or not? And then we can talk about, okay, now you've taken the job and we're going to talk somewhat differently because it becomes about incentives and not just about helping us figure out if we have a fit. Before you join X, one of my questions would be, hey, John, we're considering having you here at X. Awesome that you're interested. You're a great entrepreneur. I just want to check though, because most entrepreneurs start with like an idée fixe. I want to make flying cars or whatever that is. And then they just want to blast through walls, walk over hot coals to make their vision a reality. And I assure you, if you come to X with that attitude, you will be miserable. This isn't a popular thing to say, the following isn't a popular thing to say around Silicon Valley. But I believe that people who are doing that and people who invest in that, it works sometimes, but it's gambling. It works like you can go to Vegas and put money on six on the roulette wheel. You can make money, but I wouldn't recommend that as an investment strategy, which is why the venture capital community overall doesn't make money relative on a risk-adjusted basis relative to the just putting your money in the market. So we're going to be the card counters of innovation. It is a very different process. You have to give up a lot of what you feel as an entrepreneur is like how it's done. So please don't come to X unless you're actively excited about practicing card counting. And I want you to think about that because I assure you people rage quit from X. I'm not kidding about this. So we would go through an extended process to see whether doing the card counting version instead of the gambling version, actually practicing, helping the portfolio get as good as it can be rather than have your idea win. Is that going to be interesting to you? Is that going to be personally fulfilling to you? Because if not, please don't come and work at X. Because I have to reserve my right to torture you after you get to X if we haven't understood each other about this, because I am trying to optimize the portfolio for Alphabet. Once you join X, we would have a different conversation, more about failure and things like that, where I would say, hey, you haven't practiced failing a lot. Our society makes it seem like a bad thing. But let's just start with the following thought experiment. The last really hard thing you did, especially if you're an engineer, was some kind of engineering thing. Imagine you had to throw away all the code, all the hardware, schematics, whatever that is. You get to keep your team, what's in your head, but you've lost all the stuff. How long would it take for you to recreate that thing, which probably wasn't even a moonshot? I've asked this to hundreds of people and I get answers between, 5% and 20% the total time just to recreate the final thing that you got to. And I say, great, let's call it 10%. We need a name for the other 90% of that time that you spent. I'm going to call that 90% learning. And that wasn't even a moonshot. I guarantee you it's 98% for moonshot taking. So if 98% of what's hard is learning, not the making part, then we need to be obsessed with learning. And when you have a hypothesis and your hypothesis is confirmed, you learn a little, but not much. You know when you learn a lot? When you think you know what's going to happen and you're wrong. That's when we learn. I got through that whole process without saying failure, but that's what failure is. You tried something, you didn't get what you thought you were going to get, you learn, you repeat. That's the tight loop we want to be in. So if you're not obsessed with failure and can't see failure as a really exciting part of the process to get to success, you're just going to hate being at X. So those are two different stories, the before you got to X story and the after you got to X story.
Okay, we're doing some sort of pseudo role playing and you asked me that question. Will you be okay if your entrepreneurial idea gets thrown away in a week, right? And I know you didn't exactly put it that way. And I really want the job, so maybe I give you the answer I think you want to hear, or I convince myself that I actually have the capacity to do that. And maybe some people truly do. Some people have to learn it, and others maybe think they can and have to learn the hard way that they don't. But one way or another, I take the job, I join the team, and I find it almost impossible to believe that given sort of the types of passionate people that I know you bring into your world, the big types of problems they're focused on, it probably doesn't take really long for them to get down the rabbit hole before they get pretty emotionally invested in the thing, right? It's human nature. And I think maybe a good thing about human nature, the emotional attachment we can create to those things. How do you lead people through that when you're failing 9,999 times out of 10,000?
It's really hard. This is my entire job. So you have described it perfectly. And to be super transparent, we have a joke at X, we're the worst moonshot factory in the world, except for all the other ones, which is sort of like we can have some pride in what we're doing and we're really far away from our aspirational, best version of ourselves. There are a lot of people at X, I might even say the majority of the people at X, who to some non-trivial degree are suffering from exactly what you described. And we can't even fully have the conversation because X is so clear with them from the beginning about what the game is that we're going to be playing. They heard it, but then they feel different. And then they don't even know exactly how to fight because they have this emotional experience that's calling to them. It's at odds with what X is trying to ask them to do. And they get a little stuck in the middle. So a lot of what X is trying to help people through that process. There are lots of ways to do it. Some of them are very emotionally oriented. For example, Google has Googleween, Halloween, we all get people at Google dress up. X is like a little sister to Google. So as a separate entity, we chose not to have Google Ween, but to celebrate the Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos. And we use that as a time to remember people who've gone from our lives, but also to help people with the catharsis of letting go of the projects and efforts, the professional activities that we've had to let go of. So that's an example of an emotional infrastructure that we put in place to help people, one of many. There are also intellectual infrastructures. So for example, I say, hey, John, let's say your project has an Achilles heel. It's hiding in there somewhere. Would you like to know about it now? Or would you like to spend millions of Alphabet's dollars and waste years of your life and then discover its Achilles heel, which causes the whole thing not to work?
Well, of course I want to.
And you say, well, when you put it that way, I guess now. And I say, oh, okay, so let's really drive hard at discovering whether there's any Achilles heels there. Another way to ask that question is to say, what do you think, John? Should we practice intellectual honesty or intellectual dishonesty at the end of every experiment we run? You're like, well, okay, if you're asking it that way, I guess intellectual honesty. Oh, okay, great, John. Let's take a break from our passion and be dispassionate. Let's practice. So I think there are also intellectual ways to help people practice and get past these emotional speed bumps. And after 1,000 rounds of practicing, it hurts less. Not none, but less.
Well, there's so many things about your circumstances, your organization, of course, the resources, the vision of the course, the larger leadership to support you in doing all of this that feels like extraterrestrial to a lot of people, right? Because the typical, from the 10-person company to even the large blue chip retailer may not have that sort of latitude or that kind of vision from the high leadership. But that's the kind of thing, though, that actually, I don't care what job you're in, if you're managing and leading people or building a company of any size or shape, there's practical lessons to be learned from that, right? Because being candid, that open and intellectually honest conversation, those things break down in almost every interpersonal relationship between people in the workforce or cross-organizational or up and down, right? And so that's the kind of thing I would love for people to take from this conversation is how do you map what you guys are doing on this really grand scale to their day-to-day interactions with their team or their managers or their customers, right?
100%. In fact, many people would say, oh, well, you can do that because Alphabet has lots of money. I actually think it's exactly the opposite. The more money you have, the more you can afford to BS yourself about the fact that your project is probably dead, a zombie is dead in the water, and you just like continue it for years. God knows every large company in the world is sort of overrun with that kind of mediocrity.
Right.
Yes. If you're running short of money, then you better be doing what I just described, which is going and finding the zombies, being intellectually honest. That one's just not going to make it. And you have to create an environment for your employees where them admitting that, even helping you find the zombies and putting them underground in your business, is good for them as individuals. If you don't do that, they're not going to be like, my project is a zombie, let's turn it off. So the less money you have, the more you should be practicing this, not the less.
So related topic, another thing I know you're really keen on is the value and importance of in-person collaboration, particularly, I know, and that's such a big issue. It's a complicated issue right now because there's sort of like two forces at work here. We all kind of know, particularly as leaders and entrepreneurs and business leaders, that there is measurable inherent value in face-to-face interaction. We also know that to instill the kind of culture you're talking about, that sort of, hey, your thing's a zombie, that sort of radical kind of discretion and candor, you have to have trust in place first to be able to do that, right? People need to understand that when you come to them and tell them that their idea is terrible, it's because you're trying to help them as well. You're trying to free them of going further down a path and creating more work for themselves and all that. And then at the other end, you've got this pressure right now, which is people, individuals, kind of liked working from home to varying degrees, and they feel like it's better for their quality of life. How do you reconcile that friction? And what do you think it says about sort of the future of work? Where's this going? Because right now we're obviously in the very early stages of this experiment.
First of all, let me just tell you where X happens to land on this. We've told Xers that we're a majority in-person environment. And that didn't just start now. That actually is like 12 years that we've since we've started, because we're a creativity factory that uses technology as our paint palette. And so telling people to punch a clock is just disconnected from being a creativity factory. So we have always had the attitude, we need to have a lot of time together for all the reasons that you were just describing. And if you need alone time, if that's how you can get some of your work done, by all means, go do that. I want to recognize for a second, COVID has complicated many people's lives. Some people have young children who they until very recently couldn't get vaccinated, so, or have other people they have to care for, immunocompromised. So it has been complicated, just to be clear. And I recognize that and X has, I hope, a lot of patience for helping everyone at X work through that. But the reason that we are still going to be a majority in-person environment is, as you just said, because a lot of the thing that we're harvesting, the trust is the foundation, and then we want our ideas to clash into each other, and the sparks that fly off from those collisions is exactly what we harvest. And doing that through the transactional screens that you do when you're remote, when you're sitting in your bedroom, it's just not the same. So what I would say is there's a spectrum. When it's super clear what people need to do, and they really can do it from home, like software widget making, whatever that is, sure, I guess they can do it almost exclusively from home. Customer service, maybe a good example of something where they could be mostly at home. I am open to the idea that there are some jobs that really can be remote, and I have no objection with that being an important part of our society going forward. On the other end of the spectrum, when what's hard about what you're doing is figuring out what work you should be doing, and X is a great example of this, when everyone retreats to their bedrooms, they might get a lot of stuff done, but it's not at all clear that they're doing the right stuff, because that's the hard work, is finding out what stuff to do. And that's a group activity, not an individual activity. So I think every company needs to figure out for itself what mix of work people can do solo because it's really transparent what the work is. And when the real question is, how do we get the trust together and the creativity together, which is, I think, usually done best together, so that we change what work we're doing? And I don't care what company you're talking about, that has to be at least 10 or 20% of any company's job, no matter how steady state they believe they are in their industry. For X, it's obviously 99% of our job.
Yeah, I think you're under, I would take the over on that, Astro, because whether the company think, so yes, maybe the company believes it's somewhere along that spectrum. But I think people, because again, we're still so new at this, and we rationalize that, yes, I can do my job at home as well as I could do it if I was in an office. Maybe the value of collaboration, those kinds of things aren't self-evident to me yet. But if I'm, again, putting aside certain types of jobs and maybe certain types of people, if my job or my company isn't a creative factory in some way, shape, or form, maybe not to the extent you are, then we're just standing still, right? And who wants to work in that environment? Who wants a career like that, right? Because all you're doing is essentially punching a clock on a screen all day versus either you're passionate about what your company and your job does and you want to make it better, or you're passionate about advancing your career in a way which involves creativity and critical thinking and all that kind of collaboration, putting aside sort of the value of networking and relationships and all of that. I feel like we're still so early in this process that the long-term effects of those things on, you know, even our mental health is in our jobs is going to be impacted in ways that don't feel, they feel counterintuitive to us today, because we think our mental health is improved by virtue of not having to commute and sit in traffic. But there are other things, other forces at work there.
100%, John. To be clear, I believe that certainly X and all of society will drift back away from remote work. But sometimes if you pound the gavel too hard, people end up in an oppositional stance. So I'm trying to invite, especially Xers, and hopefully other companies will do this too, to discover for themselves what you've just said. I agree with you that over time, I don't think remote work is going to be quite the sea change that people think for the whole basket of reasons that you just described. But people are going to need to discover that for themselves, I think, to some extent. You know, just sort of telling people, no, 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 get back to work. I just don't think that's, we're not quite there yet.
And we're still in, you know, a really, really strong seller's market in the way the workforce is set up today. And again, I don't mean to be sound Machiavellian about it. It's not just that it's going to change simply because employers will have, you know, a heavier hand in the process. But I do think there'll be a lot of time and reflection. It might take a decade or more until we really reflect on like what this did to people and creativity and which companies thrived and which ones didn't because of the different approaches. Any minute now, the first McKinsey study is going to drop about which companies had the best hybrid work. And I'm not going to take it to the bank yet because I think it's far too early. Okay, so kind of shifting gears and this is a kind of a heavy question, I think, or a lofty question. So much of what you're doing, the science and innovation behind what happens in your factory to solve these really big problems, climate's one of them, of course, and others. There's, at the same time, there's this growing problem. Again, another sort of COVID exacerbated thing is this kind of like societal burgeoning sort of like crisis in confidence as it relates to science. There are absolutely political influences on that. I mean, it's pretty much as strongly correlated as anything. Concerns about the COVID vaccine are now starting to trickle into people not wanting to get their kids vaccinated for other things. And the value of expertise, the value of the perceived value of science and medicine and whatever, there's a lack of confidence now and distrust in those areas that I don't believe we really ever had before. Maybe we did. I don't know. Maybe if I thought back in history. How do we solve that? Or do you think about the role you can play in solving that? Because the solutions you're bringing are rooted in, I know we're talking about ideas and other kinds of like esoteric things, but at the end of the day, everything you're building is rooted in really hardcore science. And we know that those problems don't get solved without it. How do we educate or how do we reverse the tides on that sort of declining level of confidence? Can we? And do you even worry about it?
We worry about it all the time. It isn't sort of our official job to solve that, but I certainly hope we can be part of the solution. Let me start by recognizing disbelief or the lack of interest in or the suspicions about science are part of a bigger rejection of sort of the elites, quote unquote, and a bunch of the smart people who know how things are done, quote unquote. A lot of people have been left behind over and over again by the status quo, by the way things currently work. And without getting into how that happened, they have legitimately, to varying degrees, been left behind. And I understand their anger. And I don't think anything's going to change it till we stop leaving them behind. So I can't fix that by myself, but I just want to flag that going out and badgering people, you have to believe in science. I don't think that's going to work because it's not about the science. I think it's about being left behind. I don't believe that we have earned the following yet, but let me tell you my aspiration. I think NASA in the late 60s through maybe the mid 80s in particular was incredibly aspirational for people. At least one, maybe two generations of people ended up with more entrepreneurial interest, more STEM interest, more of an explorer mentality because NASA had the chutzpah and the science kind of in the right mixture, and we as a society without political divisions could look up to them. So rather than us getting us X, us science, whatever, getting on a soapbox and wagging our fingers at people about how it is and how people should think, I would hope that science in general, I can't control science in general, so let's see X specifically, can we do enough good things for the world with science and technology that it inspires people, that it creates for them some of what NASA did in the 70s, where people are like, yeah, I want to be part of that when they're a six-year-old. And then they grow up and they retain some of that. That's what I hope X and maybe places like X can be for the next one or two generations. And I think it's a long play. It's not a short play, but I hope it can be a pervasive effect on society if people can look up to science again as a way to solve problems instead of a way to create climate problems or a way to create inequality, which is kind of how they see it right now.
Great answer. Great answer. It's one of the things I have just found most discouraging, because when people are rejecting expertise, I don't know how you fix that. I hadn't thought about the NASA. That's a really interesting historical perspective. Okay, well, look, really big, heady topics, issues, incredibly thoughtful points of view. We're going to dial it down to just a handful of fun questions I like to ask all our guests at the end of our time together. These are our poll questions, so I'll be able to compare your answer to both mine and the rest of the U.S. First and foremost, how likely are you to tell a stranger they have something in their teeth?
70%.
Yeah, we'll call that somewhat likely. Yeah, I mean, that's me too. Or their collars.
It depends, right? It's a little bit sort of
but
the context.
70% of people say they're unlikely to do it, which is, you know, unfortunate, because I probably have stuff in my teeth quite a bit. This one, unfortunately, because we ask multiple choice, this list could be 100 answers long, and we've got about 10 of them with an other. But who's your favorite superhero?
Doctor Strange.
He's going to be
in. Has been since I was a kid, actually.
That's cool. Unfortunately, he's in the other category. We've got Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, Iron Man, Black Panther, Wonder Woman, Wolverine. You're in the other category. I would have, now that you say that, I probably should have thought to guess that for you. Mine's Batman, but it's almost disqualified because there's a debate about whether he's actually a superhero, because he doesn't really have any magical powers. He just like has cool toys.
Close second for me was Professor Xavier. Also
okay.
Not on your list.
No, also, but yeah, I dig that one for sure. Window seat or aisle?
Aisle.
Yeah, me too. So believe it or not, it's 43. What's that?
Small bladder club.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just like, I'm claustrophobia club. But it's actually like, so it's 46% window, 36% aisle. And believe it or not, and then there's some people that say I don't fly. 9% of people say middle. I feel like they should be on a watch list of some kind, because I can't.
I like the window better, but I hate asking people to get up so I can go to the bathroom. So.
Oh, see. I will use the window only if it's like a red eye, and because it's a little bit better to put your head against the side of the plane to sleep, but all other times I'll take the aisle. But yeah, I don't know who prefers the middle. That's like my worst nightmare as a claustrophobic. A little heavier. Do you believe in fate?
Not really. I feel like you can influence luck by playing the game over and over again, but no, I don't think outcomes are predetermined.
I'm with you too, but we're in the minority, about 2/3 to 1/3. Most people do believe in fate. There's probably a high correlation there between experience in science and focus in science, I suppose, but I don't believe in it. I'd like to think I have more control over my future than that.
I want to have control over my future, and I feel like I have responsibility for the things that have happened to me.
Yeah.
I don't want to be able to blame that on the fates.
Yes. Yes. I 100% agree. Well put. Last but not least, have you ever read a book that completely changed your life?
To varying degrees, yeah, several.
Can you pick one? And it doesn't have to be the number one, but what comes to mind?
Dune, Cyrano de Bergerac, the play, The Jungle Books by Kipling, the Mowgli stories in particular. I wanted to be Pippi. The first person I wanted to be was Pippi. I had read the Pippi books when I was a kid. So she was actually the first superhero I wanted to be. But I've always used characters from fiction and anchored aspects of them that I wanted to emulate. I used them like North Stars to pull me towards the aspects of their character that I want to improve about myself. And so when I catch something that just works for me, that I feel like it locks in, and I associate it with that story, not because the story itself is important, but because, like in the case of Dune, the ability to control your reaction to fear, which is one of the central themes in the book, that was just the first time I was exposed to some of those thoughts. And so I associate all of the work I have since done to control, I'm somewhat counterphobic, and to control my reactions to fear, and I think of that as super central to who I am as a person, I associate that with the book Dune.
Well, your answer is so much better than mine. And thank you for being candid about that, because I'm not sure my answers go in quite that level of depth, actually. And now I'm kind of, you know, I've never been as much of a fiction reader. I've been much far more of like a nonfiction reader. I read a lot of history, and it's just maybe lands a little bit differently. They've changed my perspective on the world in certain ways. First, I'll say that only 25% of people say they've ever read a book that completely changed their life. Now, maybe completely is a strong word, but still, I mean, maybe they haven't read enough, or hopefully they find that book that does that for them. You know, mine are actually two history books, sort of. One's a book called Founding Brothers, and it was about the founders of the U.S. founders, you know, constitutional period, and just sort of how so many of the things that set our country on its path, and putting aside all the warts on all of those people that we all know are there, but how many of the things and the decisions that were made in one-on-one conversations in bars and restaurants and things that they had, which was really just more about like, you had this perception of like all those huge decisions being happening in this large room and these big events, but really what the value of like one-to-one and it kind of ties back to what we're talking about, the importance of trust, right? In solving problems and big problems, right? And so that book, that just always stuck with me. The other one is a book called Generations by a guy named Neil Howe. He coined the term millennial, which I forgive him for, but then wrote a book called The Fourth Turning that he's far better known for. But this book he wrote, in the, I guess it was the early 90s, that just sort of really understood how generational cohorts build on each other and relate to each other. It gave me a sense of a perception into the way the world works and the way people work, and explaining why people behave the way they do, that literally, I will say, it changed my life because it changed my perspective. So, well, look, Astro, so great to have you here. This podcast is called The Dumbest Guy in the Room, and this is exactly why. You have always been one of the more thoughtful people I've ever known. You know, we met over 20 years ago as wet behind the ears startup founders. Like, it's so hard to believe. And to have watched your career elevate to the place it is today. Yeah, I'm super envious of the work you get to do and the freedom with which you get to do it. But you've earned all of that. There's nobody I can say I've ever met in my life that I would rather have or trust in the position that you're in than you. And so I'm so proud of you, proud to call you a friend, grateful for you to come and share your thoughts with everyone here today. I may ask you to come back sometime when we'll tackle the next world's big problems a few years from now, because I'm sure there's some we aren't even seeing yet. But best of luck to you, and best of wishes to you and your family.
Oh, likewise, John, that was totally fun. I would do this over a beer with you anytime, whether or not it's being recorded for a podcast. Come visit X. Love back to your family. Thank you.
All right,
that was really great.
Thanks.